Good afternoon. We'll call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. We're about 1:35. We've got Senator Meyer, Senator Costello, Senator Wilikowski, and Chair Coghill here. Today, the agenda is going to be Senate Bill 54. We got a fiscal note. We're going to describe that to the committee. The bill is the same as we adopted last time. I haven't received any amendments, so my hope is to bring it up for a discussion and a vote. We have the House Bill 77, which is the revisor's bill. Lisa Kirsch is here. She will explain that to us. And then the collection of civil litigation information, which we heard, many of us heard last year, is here. It's the chairman of the other Judiciary Committee on House Bill 104. If time allows and he can get here from his committee, we will bring that up. And it's a pretty straightforward bill. But before I do that, what I'd like to do is get a microphone in front of me. How are we doing? All right. I'm sorry. I was going on without a microphone. My apologies to all who listen in and to those who have to record this. So on March 6th, we had testimony on House Senate Bill 54 from Butch Moore, and the testimony just was not true. It was a false testimony. He called and apologized for some of it, and the ones he apologized for, I'll explain two of them, but there's a third one that that he either was unaware of or in any case needs to be corrected. The claim number one that was false was the criminally negligent homicide offenders can receive a suspended imposition of sentence and it goes off their criminal record. That's just not true. Charged persons with criminally negligent homicide are not eligible for a suspended imposition of sentence, and it does stay on the criminal record. He did call and say that he apologized for that. The other claim that was false, prior to Senate Bill 91, he said the sentence of Class B felonies is 1 to 3 years, now it's 0 to 2. Wrong. Senate Bill 91, prior to Senate Bill 91, Class B felonies that were a first felony conviction were subject to a presumptive range of 1 to 3 years. There's no minimum in the presence of mitigating factor, and it's a maximum of 10 years in the presence of an aggravating factor. So if there are prior felonies, the sentence goes higher. The one that I think that troubled me most was the claim that Senate Bill 91 allowed Esteban Santiago to murder 5 people in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. It was most troubling to me. He said that Santiago was charged with multiple C felonies in January 2016. We checked with the Anchorage people and state. He was charged with A misdemeanors. So Mr. Moore was wrong on that. He also stated that the municipality of Anchorage entered into a deferred sentencing agreement because SB 91 was coming. We checked with the municipality. They said, the prosecutor's office said, call those claims untrue, and that the decision to enter into a deferred sentencing agreement had nothing to do with Senate Bill 91, which was not law at the time. Additionally, if any individual successfully completes requirements of a deferred sentencing agreement, prosecution generally dismisses the case. In Santiago's case, he violated his conditions, which is why the charges were not dismissed, and that remains an open case. Mr. Moore also said, because of Senate Bill 91, they let him go after violating the conditions of release, and that's just not true. Senate Bill 91 was not law at the time, and Santiago was charged with violation of condition of release, punishable up to 180 days per their agreement, following a compliance check with the Anchorage Police Department. Mr. Moore also said that because of Senate Bill 91, subsequent contacts with law enforcement did not lead to arrest or incarceration. Mr. Santiago had several contacts with law enforcement following Senate Bill 91's passage, and according to the municipality of Anchorage, law enforcement officers chose not to arrest Santiago, and the municipality did not bring charges, both of which had nothing to do with the Senate Bill 91. So the decision to arrest and charge offenders is based on facts of the investigation, not newly enhanced or enacted legislation. Also, the last thing that I'll say is, Mr. Moore asserted that there was no jail time for violating a restraining order, and that's just not true. The crime of violating a protective order is an A misdemeanor. So while there are maybe some perceived value in blaming the Fort Lauderdale Airport shooting on 91, the facts are just don't substantiate that claim. I wanted to read that into the record because testimony does matter here and getting it right. And so when we get people who make claims such as that, I will probably try to correct that record if I possibly can, and that was what that was for. With that, we're going to go to Senate Bill 54 and the sentencing bill. And what I'd like to do is have Jordan kind of go through that fiscal note, if that's all right with the committee. And then we'll go to any other discussion on the bill. Mr. Schilling.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. For the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. I'll be going through the Department of Corrections fiscal notes. I'm a little bit new to this note. We got it last night. I'm going to attempt
just to let you know from the chairman, I'm disappointed that it took so long to get the fiscal note. Number one, I said that the last committee hearing. We finally did get one, and then having the department come before the committee became nigh unto impossible. The commissioner was flying, and the person who is responsible for writing is on personal leave, and so not available. What I understand is that there's tension in the department between the departments, and that this is probably a very conservative fiscal note. So as my intention is when I lay the bill out in front of the next committee to bring that point up so that it'll be scrutinized. All right? Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm just going to be briefly summarizing some aspects of the narrative. The total amount that the fiscal note provides for FY18 and beyond is $4.33 million. And based on projections that were used for Senate Bill 91 last year, the department is projecting an increase to the inmate population as a result of the CS to Senate Bill 54 of approximately 286 inmates per day.
Excuse me a second, Mr. Schilling. Welcome, Senator Kelly. And Senator Kelly, I'm going to pass this down to you, but I want it back. I just read this into the record.
Okay.
And we're on the fiscal note for Senate Bill 54. And the intention is to bring it up for discussion, debate, and a vote if we can get there. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. So the total cost, the total projected cost of this CS to Senate Bill 54 is up to $4.33 million, and that consists of approximately 286 additional inmates per day. And that's based on a daily marginal offender rate of $41.49 per inmate. But diving into the individual.
Before you go any further, we have a question, Senator Meyer.
Well, I thank you, Mr. Chairman. In looking at the fiscal note, it says it could be zero up to 4.3. That's quite a range. I would anticipate a range like that, you would have an indeterminate fiscal note, Mr. Chairman. And so I'm wondering if, well, you said nobody's here to explain it. So they gave us a fiscal note that's got a range of 0 to 4.3 million, and nobody can explain it.
They are showing a range because, quite frankly, we gave them a 0 2 on three different felony and misdemeanor charges. So they're saying it could be. That's about the best they could do, but I think you're right. It would be nice to be able to get a little deeper scope on it. So my intention is to make sure that that is highly scrutinized when we get to Finance Committee. It's unfortunate that we don't get that chance here.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, so the fiscal note could be zero, or it could be $4.3 million. So that's why I would have anticipated an indeterminate fiscal note because you just don't know. It's probably somewhere in between there.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I think you're right, and you are as well, Mr. Chairman, that because a lot of these policies have discretion and sentencing ranges that go from, for example, 0 to 1 year for the C felony, I think that's why you'll find the fiscal note referring to ranges as well. If every individual who was convicted of a C felony and they had no prior felonies, if all of them were sentenced to 0 days in prison, you're right, the cost would be zero. And then, of course, in the converse, if everyone were sentenced to the maximum of a year, you know, it would be the full cost within that range.
further discussion?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman, but no further discussion. It's just I wish there was an explanation because at least an indeterminate would show that it could be somewhere in that range between 0 and 4.3. Whereas if I look at the fiscal note now, I'm going, holy cow, it's $4.3 million. And the reality is it probably isn't.
And I share your frustration.
Okay, good. Thank you. I feel better now.
I wish I had a better discussion on that. I just share that.
Okay.
That's why I'm expressing my disappointment.
It feels you, man.
And however, what I don't want to do is wait till next week to pass this out. And unless you guys just feel like as a vote you have to. And so please continue.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, you had mentioned then that you're going to rely on the Finance Committee to dive into these numbers a little bit deeper.
Absolutely.
Than we're able to today. Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. And I will express that there was some concern within the committee, certainly starting from the sponsor to at least one committee member at this point.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, you have to understand, as an old Finance Committee member, I can't help myself, but I trust our Finance Committee will take care of that. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue, Jordan.
Thank you, Senators. So if we were to break that total cost down by the individual policies in the bill, we could start with the C felony policy that provides for a presumptive range of 0 to 365 days for a C felony. And this fiscal note projects an increase to the inmate population of approximately 196 persons per day at a cost of up to $2.96 million. And that, again, is based on the daily marginal rate per inmate, that is $41.49.
And the marginal rate, just for what it's worth, is the cost of incarceration minus the facility charges, basically, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So the next provision in the narrative of this fiscal note refers to the mandatory minimum probation term lengths for felony sex offenders. And this is expected to result in an increase of 24,837 probation supervision days. And this would increase the daily average probationer by 68, which would require additional resources. I think it's noteworthy, though, that the fiscal note does not provide for any additional full-time employees to accommodate the increase in probation caseloads resulting from this policy. The next policy that the fiscal note addresses is the Class A misdemeanor policy, whereby a second conviction of an A misdemeanor would result in a sentence from 0 to 60 days. This policy is projected to increase the inmate population by approximately 73 persons per day, and again could increase the cost by up to $1.10 million, which is, again, 73 people annually based on the daily marginal offender rate of $41.49. Next, the policy with respect to violation of conditions of release, which allows for a sentence of not more than 5 days, is projected to increase expenditures by up to $136,294, and that is 9 inmates. Again, at the marginal rate of $41.49. The next policy the fiscal note addresses is the changes we've made to theft in the fourth degree and similar offenses. It provides for up to 10 days of active imprisonment for a third and subsequent offense, and up to 5 days for a second conviction. This change would impact the inmate population reductions that were predicated in passing 91 and is projected to increase the inmate population by approximately 8 persons per day. And it is anticipated that this could cost up to $121,000 for those 8 people. Next, the narrative of the note addresses the 5-year look-back period for the purposes of counting priors for our A misdemeanor aggravators. And it says that the department is unable to quantify the impacts of this section and provides a reason for that. And then the narrative refers to two aspects of the bill that are definitely not anticipated to cost money, and one is the sex trafficking provisions that remove the loophole and attempt to address the original problem that was attempted to be addressed last year, and also the provision in the bill that limits the use of pretrial risk assessments for defendants who are not detained in a DOC facility following arrest.
All right, Senator Costello, your question.
Thank you. Jordan, on the second paragraph where the department says they're not sure what the impact will be on the look back for prior convictions. Mm-hmm. So are we, did you have any discussion with the department as to whether or not this means they may come back with an additional request from the legislature? Or do you think that we just have to also consider that the original number might not be adequate, so they would just, we would hear back from them as to what the impact is on this?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Costello, that's a really good question. I think if anything, if they could quantify the impact of that provision, it would actually be a reduction.
Okay.
Because by creating a five-year look-back period, we are reducing the likelihood that a misdemeanor that happened, say, 10 years ago would count in a way that would increase someone's sentence. So I think, if anything, this would actually be a reduction.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? I will make sure that we express our thanks and frustration all at one time. That brings the CS for Senate Bill 54, as we have CS'd it here, I think, three different times before us. Any other further discussion on the bill? Senator Costello.
Am I moving it?
Yep. That's the R version, right?
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, I move CS for Senate Bill number 54, Judiciary Version 30-LS0461/Romeo from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection to moving Senate Bill 54 to the next committee referral? Seeing none, what we'll do is we'll excuse Jordan so he can get the document for us, and we'll take a brief at ease. Judiciary Committee back to order. The next thing we get to do is House Bill 77, which is the revisor's bill. And we have with us here Lisa Kirsch, who's going to come and explain it to us. Revisor's bill, for those, anybody listening in online, is where they find incongruencies, misspellings, places where federal codes have changed, which has always been a pain in my side. But at least we catch them and change them. Thank you for the kind of work you do, because this is probably pretty close to tedium, and yet it's so important that we get our statutes right. And it's a service to the people of Alaska. I don't know that many people know how much goes in rooms with computers that people never get to see, or the value that we do for the people of Alaska, but this is a service to the people of Alaska for which I will, on their behalf, say thank you. So please present the bill.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lisa Kirsch. I am an assistant revisor with Legislative Legal, and as the chair has already stated, this is a bill, it's mostly a housekeeping bill. It allows us an opportunity to clear up any obsolete provisions, to change anything that was missed in the process of drafting bills quickly during the legislative session. And at the direction of the Legislative Council, we prepare this for the legislature and bring it before you so that you can have an opportunity to look and see if you think there's anything in here that's actually a substantive change. That's something that we generally avoid in the revisor's bill. We're trying just to correct problems without changing the substance of the law. So in this particular revisor's bill, we have six sections that delete, repeal, or update obsolete provisions. We have 22 that correct errors or oversights, as I was saying, things that maybe didn't get changed in an earlier bill that should have been caught. 32 sections that improve the form and the substance of the law. So those would be things that would be like grammatical changes, spelling changes, maybe a reordering of words that doesn't work very well because of some changes that were made along the way. So we also have quite a few sections in here, if you've looked at the sectional, that remove the words "but not limited to." That's something that we perennially take care of. There's a lot of those still remaining in statute, and we do a few of them each time we have a revisor's bill. There's a provision in Title I, Section 01-10-040B, that allows us to do that. It says anytime you use the words, the word including or includes or something like that, it means but not limited to as well, so that if you say includes, you can just say includes, and you don't have to include the words but not limited to every time you say it. So it just makes things a little cleaner, and it's one of those global provisions in Title I that applies throughout the Alaska statutes unless we say otherwise. So I can go through section by section, but if there are any specific sections you'd like me to speak to, I can do that. There are quite a few sections, so if time's an issue, we may want to...
I don't know that I would have you go through section by section, because I think categorically you've stated it pretty clear, but one of the reasons why I read these are for federal code updates, and any places that were matching the federal code, what, if any, is a change in policy that is different than the actual citation in our statute. The other thing that I'm always alert to is some years ago, probably 100 years ago, I can't remember, there was actually a gender name change that actually ended up in a court that was done in a revisor's bill, but was precedent setting that we just missed. It was not on purpose, as far as I know, and yet the court leaned on it very heavily for a gender-specific question. I remember that. So that's one of the reasons why I watch very closely what we do. And you did have some descriptions of various different people. Like I saw the senile person one, where you just put person in there. And so questions like that. We don't have to. I was just asked, do we need to bring up a version of this bill? And the fact is, the version before us is the House amended, which I was going to ask you. There was a floor amendment on the House floor. You might just point that to us so that we have an idea what that was.
Yes, Chair Coghill, that particular floor amendment was an oversight on my part. There was a definition that was no longer used in the statutory sections that where it had been used before, that it had been deleted from those sections, but this orphaned definition was still out there. The term defined was nurse midwife, and what we discovered was that effective this summer, that definition had already been deleted. So that was the floor amendment, was to remove that repealer. And so that repealer appeared in the O version before the amendment as Section 60. There were two unnecessary definitions repealed there. Now there's only one.
Okay.
So that was that change.
Which is generally unusual for a revisor's bill to be amended on the floor. So that caught my attention. Is there questions that I'll tell you how I'd like to proceed, but maybe there's questions from some of the committee members? Anything? Tell you what I would like to do. This is our first hearing on it. What I'd like to do is have staff members look at it so that you don't have to go through every single one, because I think once people read the sections like I did, they'll begin to see fairly clearly that it's either upgrading, whether it's department language. Is there anything from your perspective as a revisor that gets even close to a policy call that might you might want to bring our attention to?
Chairman Coghill, no. That is one of the things we try and avoid. Mm-hmm. So if there are sections that appear to have an issue in that regard, I'd be happy to speak to it. But, you know, that is something that we avoid doing within a revisor's bill.
Yeah, some of the repealers are everything that I've looked at so far seems absolutely appropriate. So I haven't had a chance to look at every page and every line yet, and I don't know that I'd want you to go through each one. I think we could spend some time doing that privately rather than take our time having somebody type it all up. Yeah. And so what I would like to do is have the committee members look at it, flag questions, and then we can get this before us for that very reason. And if there's no concerns, then my intention is to move it along. So if there's no questions at this point, I'm just going to hold it, and we'll look at it. And my intention is to bring it up as soon as I feel that everybody's had a chance to read it, and I'll kind of keep a poll on the members. Senator Meyer, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any public testimony on this bill? And if so, are we taking that today or Monday?
There is no public testimony on this bill.
Okay.
And if I did that, I would probably just close down public testimony when we bring it up.
Okay.
Because I really, at this point, it's been on basis. It's as I said, it's important, but it's not probably the most exciting reading. And so... but it's important for us to look through and look for any place that might cause us some concern and bring it to the revisor's attention. Because it's a committee process, and as we know, committees always make things better. That's on the record, isn't it? Senator Costello.
Thank you. And I just have a question about process. So you really take every statute, every law that's passed in a session, and then you, once it becomes a part of the body of law, then you someone reads through all of that? Is that how you go about doing this? Or what is the process? Because it does seem like a Herculean effort, and I want to thank you for that. I know it's a very important bill.
Through the chair, Senator Costello, What we typically do and what results in this particular bill, we have a directive in statute that we review each title. So generally what happens is various attorneys, drafting attorneys who draft in those areas, they'll get a title or two to review depending on the length of the title, obviously. Sometimes we actually have to break titles in half if it's a large one. And then they do that review. They report back to us. We look at the things that they think may be problems. A lot of times that involves going back and researching through the session laws that led to those changes to try to tease out, as Senator Coghill said, you know, whether or not this is actually a change that matters or whether it's something that we can do within the context of a revisor's bill. And from that point, that information that we gather about various and sundry, you know, issues within the context of the statutes, we might either talk to the Department of Law, we might talk to, you know, among ourselves as to whether it's something that's appropriate for the revisor's bill. Because sometimes there are things that just have to be done in a substantive law, cannot be done through the revisor's bill. And then most go into what ultimately starts to become a draft. And then throughout the year, we'll occasionally get phone calls from other branches of government, from legislators. They'll say, gosh, this doesn't look right. Is this a mistake? You know, this section doesn't look like it's lettered or numbered correctly, or any number of different things. Then we also get notes back from the publisher. Quarterly, we have reports that come back from the publisher asking us questions about things when the new laws are incorporated into the database. So we get quarterly, you know, stacks of questions from them that we go through, and sometimes issues there will pop out. Sometimes it'll be, you know, calls from, you know, any number of different people, practitioners who've come across a section of the law. So it's a compilation of a variety of information from our review, from our work with the publishers, with our work incorporating the laws that pass in the session before.
Thank you.
So my intention is lay the bill aside, let you look at it, and then dispatch it when we come back next. And if you or your staff can come up with questions, that would be the time to bring it up. And I will do the same as a chairman. If I have questions, I'll probably get to Lisa and ask those questions so that, and I would encourage you to do the same. That way we can, you know, take all dispatch on this. Thank you very much, Lisa.
You're welcome.
So House Bill 77, I'm going to lay aside at this point. And do we have a sponsor for House Bill 104 here at this point? Oh, we do. Okay, good. Thank you, Lisa. Appreciate
Thank you.
Very much. So now we have House Bill 104, which is an act relating to information about civil litigation and the Alaska Judicial Council and repealing some rules. Thank you for coming to the committee. I know we run our committee the same time your boss runs his committee. So, and the way our schedule fit today, if I had taken it at ease, we might not have been able to get to it. So, House Bill 104, version D is before us, and we have sponsors staff here, so please introduce yourself and introduce the bill for us.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lizzie Kubitz, and I'm staff to Representative Klayman, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, as you mentioned. He hopes to join us potentially at some point. Thank you for hearing House Bill 104 this afternoon. House Bill 104 eliminates the automatic reporting of information about civil case settlements currently required by law. The bill follows the advice of the Alaska Judicial Council, which has recommended that the legislature eliminate this requirement. To provide some historical context, in 1997, responding to public interest in tort reform and the work of the Governor's Advisory Task Force on Civil Justice, the legislature passed tort reform legislation. One part of the legislation responded to the task force's recommendation that the Alaska Judicial Council report on civil cases using data from forms completed by attorneys and parties in those cases. Since then, pursuant to statute, the Judicial Council has collected data provided by attorneys and litigants and has produced three reports. However, much more often than not, attorneys and litigants have failed to comply with the reporting requirement. In its most recent report from November 2011, which I believe is included in your bill packets, the Alaska Judicial Council reports that from January 2001 through December 2010, 88,873 cases were resolved in the Alaska court system that were subject to the reporting requirement. Because each case had at least two parties, the council should have received 177,746 or more reports. However, the council only received 23,257 reports. This represents about 13% of the council's conservative estimate of the number of reports it should have received. This low rate of reporting is the reason the council has not issued a report since 2011. An analysis based on 13% of potentially available data would not be reliable. Eliminating the requirement has also received support from attorneys and civil litigants, as the reporting requirement is onerous for those who follow it and unenforceable for those who don't. And just today, we received a letter of support from the Anchorage Bar Association. The Alaska Judicial Council lacks the authority and resources to enforce this outdated requirement, and the council renews its recommendation that the legislature eliminate it. I could provide a sectional analysis of the bill. It is a short bill, so I will leave that up to your decision. But before I conclude, I'll mention for the record that I believe Suzanne DiPietro, the executive director of the Alaska Judicial Council, is online and available to answer questions.
True, we do. And I do have a question, and either you or Suzanne can answer it. You said outdated, and that means either it should have been kept in place and we haven't enforced it, or it's not useful. And so do you have a way of explaining outdated to us?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I think Suzanne would probably be best to answer that, but I will say from my understanding that they did try to enforce this requirement in the past by sending letters to attorneys, and they did get a response back, and individuals did fill out the forms, but it was still a very low response. So they have tried to enforce it in various ways, but she could probably speak to that better.
Suzanne, are you online?
Yes, Senator Coghill. This is Suzanne DiPietro from the Alaska Judicial Council.
There are two questions. The first question, and then a value question, is there any value in continuing on, or do we lose value by discontinuing?
Mr. Chair, I believe it's my opinion that the information really is not that valuable to the legislature any longer, and I base that my opinion on the fact that tort reform was passed. It's been in effect for a number of years, and it isn't really sort of a live issue or an issue that it comes up really at all in legislation. The purpose of the collection of the information was to inform the legislature about the effects of tort reform, and those effects, if any, are well established at this point, and I would not believe that they're of interest. We certainly don't get any requests for information about the civil data that we collect. And then just this second part of the question, your first question regarding enforcement, Ms. Kubitz is correct. The Judicial Council staff did make efforts to encourage reporting when the law was first passed, and those efforts were quite resource intensive. They did yield better results, but we never achieved 100% reporting or really anything even very close to that.
Thank you. Is there other questions for Suzanne? I think most of us have heard this before. Mm-hmm. And so I think you're probably not going to get a lot of questions, and I think there's at least from my perspective, a good reason for doing this. But just for the record, why don't you just go through this section and explain, Liz, the way the bill is put together and what it actually will do under this this law.
Absolutely. Through the chair, Senator Coghill, this is Lizzie Kubitz again. Section 1 repeals Alaska Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 41A3, and Alaska Rules of Appellate Procedure, Rules 511C and E. Section 2 repeals Alaska Statute 0968130, which requires reporting of civil litigation information to the Alaska Judicial Council. Section 3 provides that, per the Alaska Constitution, the Act will only take effect if Section 1 of the Act receives the two-thirds majority vote of both bodies. And finally, Section 4 provides for an effective date. Copies of Rule 41A3, Rules 511C and E, and the statute that I referred to, I believe, were potentially included in your bill packets if you'd like to take a look.
Absolutely. So I think that's the deal. A court rule change always has a higher level, and so I just wanted to make sure that everybody understood that. Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this may be an unfair question for you, but this, you're right, this is not a new bill. This has been around before, but I'm trying to recall why it hasn't passed.
I could speculate on that. Timing was probably the bigger question among
last
other things.
Year? Okay.
Right. I think it was just timing. I will speculate personality.
That wouldn't happen here.
Senator Costello.
Thank you for presenting the bill. My question is just, and it's maybe for Suzanne, so of the 23,000 some reports that you did receive, will those be destroyed or will they remain in the possession of the Judicial Council?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, those documents are and have always been confidential, so we would, I suppose the paper documents, after we've entered them into our database, we dispose of them in the correct manner, considering that they are confidential documents. So whatever paper documents we have that still haven't been entered into the database, at the time that this bill passes, should it pass, we would probably just destroy those without entering them into the database, but we certainly still have the database of the information such as it is.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Further questions? I'm going to leave public testimony open in case somebody calls my office and says they want to testify on this. However, I do know that there are some lawyers willing to testify on it, but I think they've all contacted many offices already. So I'm going to set the bill aside and move it. I'm not exactly sure when I'm going to get it up. I will contact the representative's office to make sure that if we can work it out that he can be here upon the day that we move it. I'll work on that.
Certainly.
Thank you very much. So with that, we're going to set House Bill 104 aside for the moment as we continue the discussion on this. Anything else that the committee wants to bring forward? With that, we'll adjourn early today at 2:20.